Blog Talk Radio.
Listen to the song here in my heart, a melody I start but can't conceive. Listen to the sound from deep within.
Welcome to Delicious Talk Radio. This is your host, Gail Delicious Johnson. That was Beyonce, Listen. How's everybody doing this wonderful, beautiful evening? In case you guys don't know, I transplanted to Fayetteville, North Carolina last year in April, and the weather down here has just been extraordinary, beautiful. Where's winter? You know, but any day is a good day as long as we break up on this side of the dirt. Okay, well, this evening we're going to have a really good show for you. My special guest is a young lady who is an expert in stress. Her name is Mary Wingo. She was born in the United States, where she earned a PhD in human stress research from the University of North Texas. In 2014, she immigrated to Ecuador, a tiny country in South America, living in a new and very different society, opened her eyes to the unsustainable social, economic, and political cause preventable stress causes in the modern world. Dr. Wingle's aim is to clearly explain to the public the biological mechanisms behind the stress response as well as its staggering cost to society. In the past year, she has had more than 100-plus media placements, including those with BBC, ABC, and Men's Health. Dr. Wingle's academic specialty is physiology and specifically the human physiology, physical physiology stress response. Without further ado, we're going to bring our guests in this evening so we can get right into this subject of stress and stress management, because I know that stress, I don't know how true it is, but we will discuss it with Dr. Wingo as far as stress, because someone had mentioned that sometimes stress can be good for you and, you know, different things like that. But because she's an expert on it, we'll let her give us her expertise decisions on that. Good evening, Mary. Are you there?
Yes, I am here, Gail. Thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome, darling. First, tell us a little bit about how you even, what made you even want to go into this particular matter of stress.
Well, you know, Gail, it's a really, the study of stress is actually the study of adaptive mechanisms. And when I mean adaptive mechanisms, I'm talking about like Darwin's ideas of adaptation. So in essence, we're talking about fundamental, if you really want to get geeky about it, fundamental questions about the mechanisms of life and how life adapts. So these are fundamental questions. And when I got into this, you know, it was just starting to become kind of a cohesive topic, because it is one of the most, well, I will say it is the most complex topic in science, you know, very easily dwarfing quantum mechanics. Because you can look at stress at so many levels, because it's all about adaptation. You can look at it, of course, from a molecular biology level, on a gross physiological level. You can look at it on a psychological level, like, say, you know, from a trauma aspect, or from workplace stress. Or you can look at it from an anthropological, sociological level. You know, how do people act when they're all stressed out all at one time? Or even animals. Mm-hmm. How do animals react? Or we can look at it, if you really want to go high in the hierarchy, at how this affects like large social, political, and economic processes. So, yeah, this is one of those sort of unfigured out puzzles in science. And so that is what has got me very interested. And I wanted to be able to explain this to the general public, because the findings are absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the number one cause of stress?
Well,
or is it a multitude of reasons why people stress out?
Well, probably for humans in general, it's probably relational stress. It is the stress between, you know, the person in question and any other human. I mean, it can be on a, you know, the familial, it can be on a romantic, you know, basic friendship. It could be workplace stress, you know, relationships with, you know, how management does things. So, why is this? Well, when we're born the equivalent of human larvae, and we need so many years, actually decades, of care just to even get partially independent. And because of that, nature put a mechanism in our nervous system for bonding and for creating social ties, social affiliations. So humans are very, very social creatures on the average. And this is why relational stress is indeed the most prevalent stressor. Although, in modernized society, we do have unique talking points and unique stressors as well.
I was watching a program the other night, and this lady had developed, Bell's palsy. And the doctor has said she had developed that from stress. Is that a true statement? And if so, what diseases could stress possibly lead to?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. Let me sort of explain how this works. Every single disease that we have arises because of dysregulation in our stress mechanisms. I mean, we have a cascade of physiological mechanisms that go beyond, like, say, the fight or flight response. We have all heard of that. We've heard of adrenaline. We've heard of cortisol. Well, these are pieces of puzzle in a comprehensive production, if you want to say it. When you go into a stress response, it is a cascade of many responses that occur, in an effort to adapt to what the environment is throwing at you. So it can be argued every single disease is the result of some sort of dysregulation of stress on some level. It could be chemical stress. I mean, you know, if you're exposed to Fukushima's radiation, well, you know, this isn't just like, say, stress of being in traffic or stress of a bad boss or bad relationship. We're including physical and chemical stressors as well, because it all ends up in the same place. Whether you're stressed from social, emotional, chemical, or physical aspects, it all ends up in the same cascade of adaptive mechanisms. So this is what makes it very, very interesting.
Okay. Person is stressing. How can they, the management for a person who stresses? And say if a person is just constantly stressing, you know, a person who constantly stresses out, could that be due to the environment they're in, maybe the food they eat, or, you know, does it have anything to do with those type of mechanisms?
Yeah, absolutely. And then some more. This is sort of like a global concept that I want all of your listeners to totally, like, put at a gut level, totally internalize this, commit this not only to memory, commit this to your soul, because it's very important. One thing we need to understand about individual stressors or events that cause us stress as humans is that, and this is interesting, is that they're additive, okay? So, like, for instance, we've probably seen, you know, certain types of life event inventories where, you know, okay, if you have, say, a death of a spouse, you know, and you combine that, say, with the loss of a job, loss of your house, say your life really goes down. Okay, so the loss of your spouse is enough. But, like, say within a given, like, limited time period, like, say within 2 years, say you lose your spouse, but then, you know, you also lose your house, your car, your kids. I mean, you know, say just a whole bunch of extremely life-disrupting things happen all at the same time, you know, in a very, very short period of time. Well, because stress is additive, okay, one thing we understand is that the more you pile on individual stressors, the higher the risk. So we're looking at risk assessment here, Gail. This is actually risk assessment. The higher the risk of stress-related injury, stress-related illness, or even early death. So we're taking the concept of stress, because everybody knows that, okay, if you're too stressed, I mean, you know, anybody, your grandmother would have known this. If you are too stressed, your body starts breaking down. Well, we understand this, and we intuitively understand this, but we didn't quite have a grasp on the science behind this, the explanations of why this is, like I said, one of the most mysterious, one of the most, the biggest questions in science is how do you define the basic stress adaptive mechanism? And so, yes, so the thing is that when you experience a bunch of stressors all together, and some of them, they don't have to be major, okay? They can be small stressors. It operates almost like a leak, you know, like when you have a leak out of your faucet. You have a big leak, you can have a small leak. Or like, say, a leak, say, in your insulation, when, you know, your house is poorly sealed and not weatherized properly. You can have a bunch of small leaks, you know, a bunch of small, seemingly insignificant nagging stressors, okay? But when you add them all up, and especially if you add some biggies, you know, like I said, like a divorce, loss of spouse, that kind of, you know, loss of income, majorly disrupt, then, again, you've got a recipe, again, for early death. I mean, this is what it kind of culminates into. So if you would like to, I could share with your listeners the five major causes of stress in our society.
Oh, please do.
Okay, yeah, because this is just, I know that they have never heard of this before, and this will totally, I mean, this will totally blow their minds. Okay, so number one, we can relate to, but I'm going to explain this in a way that really makes sense. It's going to simplify a lot of things, make things really clear for you and your listeners. Number one, we can call this complexity, but if you want to really get technical, we call this derangement or depletion of working memory and executive functioning. And, you know, what the heck is that? What this is, we're talking about functioning primarily in the prefrontal cortex, okay? And that is a part of our brain, which is actually very, very new on the, you know, the scale of things. It came about later on in our development as a species. And a lot of our animal friends do not actually have much of a prefrontal cortex. So, well, what is it? Well, the prefrontal cortex is our major, for humans and for several other advanced animals, like say, for instance, other primates and maybe even dolphins, is our primary stress response organ. Okay, for higher level animals. Okay, so our primary stress response organ isn't the fight or flight response. I mean, it is as like for you, for animals in general, but for higher level, animals with higher, more highly developed nervous systems like we have, the frontal lobe is absolutely, it's the reason why humans dominate the animal kingdom. And what does it do? Well, you can plan ahead for the future and then follow through on those plans. So basically, this is how civilization, this is how society, became organized. Government, technology, this is what, like, this is why cats can't really form governments, or, you know, even dogs. I mean, other animals just cannot do the levels of calculation that we can in order to manipulate our environment. Okay, so we're master manipulators. And also frontal lobe, very important for regulating emotion, okay? And as Americans, especially Americans, because we're under so much stress, okay? And I live in Ecuador, so I understand not everybody handles stress like our culture does, which is very poorly. There are other cultures that do have actually a pretty ancient grasp on managing stress, because it can make the difference between life or death, especially in a more indigenous primitive cultures, which, you know, they're more closely aligned to the environment. And if they make a mistake, you know, it could cost them their life. And so we've lost that in our society. And I'm sorry, do you have a question?
No, I was clearing my throat, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, just say it interrupts me at any time, because there's a lot of cool stuff here. So basically, so what happens under stress? At low levels of stress, the frontal lobe kicks in to help us adapt and adjust to what the environment is throwing at us, okay, on a mental level, on a nervous system level, okay? And so so it's great. So in the initial parts of the stress, you know, you're okay, yeah, I have got control. But then what happens? You become fatigued, okay? And this is why, this explains a lot of stuff, Gail. This is why at the end of the day, you've had a hard, stressful day. And say you've got some bad habits. Say you smoke. Say you overeat. When are you going to do it? You're going to do it. You're going to have all your bad habits. You are such a good trooper, and you control, you controlled your diet. You controlled your addiction, your bad habits. But then what happens? You get stressed or you get very tired. And what happens? It comes back. And, you know, you overeat, you slip up, you have that cigarette, you know, and it goes on and on. Well, why? Well, it's because your frontal lobe is so tired that it cannot control your behavior, okay? And you see, as beings in advanced society, Gail, that this is bad news. I mean, that this can cause a lot, and it does. It causes a lot of problems. And another thing, every mental illness, okay, so we have in our in all modernized societies, huge amounts of mental illness that other societies, they just don't have the prevalence that our cultures, modernized cultures in general, do. Well, because our frontal lobes become so fatigued by the structure of the demands of our society, many of which we voluntarily submit to, that the frontal lobe loses control of organizing rational thought and your emotions. So every single mental illness, from schizophrenia to bipolar to all levels of obsession, anxiety, compulsions, you name it, comes from a dysregulation of the frontal lobe at some level because of some sort of stressor of some sort, okay? So this is very, very important to really kind of reframe how we understand medicine and how we understand the organization. Well, I mean, of animals, but we just, since we're interested in people, I mean, we're interested in ourselves and the how humans are organized. So it's very, very interesting. So, and how do we feed our frontal lobe? We overstack ourselves. We're not meant to be overscheduled. We're not meant to be constantly scheming, rationalizing, planning, checking our devices, having our brain fixed on some sort of mechanical device. We are not meant to be continuously exposed to this 24/7, 7 days a week. You know, you have to take a break from being overscheduled, being overtasked, overburdened, thinking, planning, strategizing, being too busy, essentially being too busy, okay? Our ancestors were not like that. Our ancestors, yeah, they were busy, but they had ample amounts of sort of free time to kind of let their brain sort of, you know, recharge it. And you see this is very important with children. Free-form play, it's very important for brain development. But what we have when we have them structured and overscheduled to where parts of their frontal lobe just can't develop. I mean, this is part of natural child development, and we've totally changed what childhood is. So this is very, very, as you see, a fascinating stressor, a very large cause of stressors. Number two is sort of kind of related. It is, but it's not with us, it's in our society. It's living in an unequal society, our unequal hierarchy, okay? So
what do you mean by an unequal hierarchy?
Well, we talk about the so-called privilege of the 1% versus the 99%. Actually, a lot of people would say the 0.01%, the extreme wealthy fat cats. Which are, basically they're looting our society. I mean, we know that. I mean, they're looting. But the rest of us, which are struggling for the scraps, actually, it's very interesting. This is a little bit of a segue, is that with the technology and automation that we have now, that has been distributed in most parts of the world. I mean, you know, again, the parts of the world still developing, but, you know, a lot of people have got access to a lot of automation and labor-saving technology that wasn't even available 10 years ago, that there's really enough to go around. The way our propaganda in our society structures it is like there's not enough to go around. There's plenty to go around. It's just our society's become so unequal in the power and wealth distribution. We're being looted so heavily. The rich are like, vacuuming up like what was it? The top richest men, 8 richest men control half of the world's resources. Well, that's not healthy. That's not healthy for society. Any economy, you know, you ask any classical economist, any type of accumulation of resources and capital into just too few hands is very, very toxic. So anyway, what happens when you are the bottom guy of the totem pole and you're always scrambling? Let me tell you, you're always adapting, right? Because you don't have good access to anything. You don't have good access to housing, to healthcare. Your job, usually, you know, you've got the worst jobs, the worst, most stressful schedules, oppressive management, you know, when you're working horrible, low-level jobs, you don't have control at all of your schedule, of your work or anything. And, you know, that kind of lifestyle, lack of access to really healthy food, you just can't afford it, you know, that kind of thing. That causes you to be in a state of constant stress and adaptation. Well, what does that do? Let me tell you what that does. It makes your body, it changes your body into a different state. You become more what we call plastic. And what that is that you become your tissues that are under stress kind of change form and they become more plastic so they can reconfigure themselves to fit what the environment is demanding. So, for instance, if you go from low altitude to high altitude, your body has to reconfigure itself so it adjusts to the thinner oxygen. And there's many, many examples. I mean, basically how we live life is, you know, a variation of that example. Well, when you're always in that state, you're only supposed to be in that sort of plastic adaptive state for limited periods of time. Stress is not meant to be continual. That's where it becomes a risk assessment. It is meant to be episodic. It's supposed to be periodical. And so when it's continual, you are in this plastic state. And when you're in this plastic state, this is when your tissues are very vulnerable to illness and injury. And so you become very, very vulnerable to everything, to whether it's injury or infections or, a lot of the issues become problems when you're continually under stress. And so that's number two. And so this is the reason you want to know, Gail, this gets really deep. You want to know why the Bernie camp exists. You want to know where the Trump camp or the Brexit exists. I mean, all these revolutions going on. It occurs because you have too many people in undergoing a stress response at the same time. And the natural, if you're looking at this on a grand anthropological, sociological, you know, like herd behavior level, revolutions are what happen over and over and over and over and over again in history. So this is not unique. When you have people worrying about, are they going to be able to live? Are they, we're talking about like, am I going to be able to feed my kids? Am I going to be able to keep a house over my head? When you have members of your society horribly worried, you know, about maybe becoming homeless and not caring for themselves or their children, you get revolutions over and over and over. And this is something for policymakers and our government to really understand. I mean, if they want to understand how revolutions work and how to stop revolutions, then you have to understand the human stress response. And so this is why we're at where we're at politically. And until we learn this, it's just going to get worse. So that's number two. Number three, you're going to relate to this, is lack of social capital. What is this translating? This lack of social support. Here in Ecuador, it almost seems like the poor, you know, it's actually fairly prosperous, but the more poor various communities get, the higher the social support. It's very interesting. It's like an automatic, the more prosperous and materialistic a society gets, the more families tend to fall apart, the more, you know, like jobs become a distance, so you have to separate from your community. You can't be born and be educated and work in your community. You have to go. So you can see where, compared to our ancestors, this is causing a major breakdown in our society. And with this, what happens? When you don't have a protective herd to protect you and to like do barter, do favors with, life becomes, number one, more expensive because you're having to pay for things that you got for free before. And number two, again, you go into that plastic state because you are under a lot of stress being on your own. Because we're, like I told you before, we are born to be social animals. And when that is torn from us, when we're living diametrically opposed to what, you know, many hundreds of thousands of years our ancestors lived, and we've changed this in the last, like, say, 50, 75, 80 years, we haven't had time to adapt. So this becomes a stressor in and of itself, lack of social capital. Number four, this is kind of like a different segue, is a depletion or derangement of your human biome. Okay, so what is that? Those are the microorganisms that exist, you know, in your gut, on your skin, in your orifices, etc. And what they do, they've evolved with us over millions of years, and they're actually part of our physical bodies. They perform functions of our bodies, like they synthesize vitamins, for instance, certain vitamins. They control signaling of the immune system, wound repair, wound healing, endocrine signaling. And so when we have a lifestyle which disrupts this very delicate balance, we lose physiological function, okay? It's like death by a thousand cuts. A little bit, you probably don't even notice, but when this goes on for years and years and years, and you have chronic vitamin depletion, you know, you've got chronic malnourishment because you're not taking, you can't produce like certain vitamins without, you know, help. You know, for instance, or, you know, you've got, you know, various physiological functions that are not functioning optimally or functioning at all. Guess what happens? Your body detects change and so goes into the stress response trying to stabilize. And so it's highly stressful and it causes a lot of problems in society. A lot of the explosion of autoimmune problems that we see, especially with the gut, is directly related to that. So this is something that greatly affects society, that no one, I mean, yeah, you know, we do talk about dysbiosis, we do talk about probiotics, but to really understand how far this goes, we need to understand how important it is to have proper relationships with the microorganisms in our life, okay? And number five is just chemical stress. This is a type of chemical stress, disruption of our human biome, but we have pollution, and we are exposed to all kinds of chemical compounds that didn't even exist 20 years ago. So what makes anybody think that we have evolved in 20, 30, 50, even 100 years, mechanisms to break down these metabolites that are left in our environment? I mean, all types. I mean, from processed food to the chemicals in our home that we use for hygiene, for cleaning, for industry, you know, especially industry. Well, like glyphosate. You know, for Roundup, you know, for, you know, the pesticide Roundup. Well, this stuff didn't exist 50, 60 years ago. This is why it's causing so many problems. This is overwhelming our systems. We do not have the ability to break these things down. So guess what happens? The body detects a stress response and you get stress-related illnesses. As a matter of fact, pollution is thought to account for 40% indirectly or directly of all deaths in the world. So of course, this is a chemical stressor. So yeah, this is five major causes of stressor in modernized society. I hope that this kind of simplifies and makes very clear how important it is to manage preventable stress in our society. I mean, what a risk. You are a walking time bomb. Seriously, people are walking unless they really get a hold of this and manage their stress.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. But right now, we're going to take a small break, and we will be back to continue discussion of stress with our guest this evening, Mary Wingo. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to call in. The call-in number is 646-652-2877. Again, the call-in number is 646-652-2877. I'm quite sure some of you out there suffer from stress at one point in your life. You may be suffering from it right now. So don't be afraid. Call in and ask your questions or leave a comment. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Bringing Sexy Back, right here on Delicious Talk Radio. There is no religion or politics spoken here, only delicious adult conversation. Audience participation is encouraged, so log in and create an account to engage in conversation in our chat room. Feel free to call in with your questions and comments at 646-652-2877. That's 646-652-2877. And let's get this delicious talk conversation going.
Technical difficulties here. what's going on.
Listen up, I got to tell you about this beautiful author and publisher, Gail Delicious Johnson. Gail Delicious Johnson is proud to announce the publication of her new, revised issue of her latest suspenseful novel, Back to Zero. Read this riveting story of intrigue, conflict, love, and suspense. Follow the trail of abuse, secrets, lies, and love. And check it out. You can't just read the back of the book, because you have to prepare yourself for the mind-blowing, explosive ending. Order your personally autographed copy of Back to Zero by visiting www.jjpublishing.com. That's www.jayjaypublishing.com. Back to Zero is a fictional story with a dash of reality. It's a tale about Anthony Thomas, a man who lost the most precious things in his life, starting with his first childhood love, Gloria. Tragedy soon followed after losing his mom to cancer, and shortly thereafter, he lost his wife, Lynn, and son, Junior, in a horrific car crash. With each traumatic incident, Anthony was branded, sending him back to zero. 30 years later, Anthony runs into Gloria, and the flames in their hearts are still burning. Gloria, now a law enforcement official who also comes with baggage, a psychotic husband named Wayne Anderson who is out of control. He too is a law enforcement official that's abusive, jealous, and an alcoholic. Wayne treats Gloria miserable. While snooping behind his wife, he finds out that she had research information concerning Anthony on the internet. Wayne goes into a rage of madness like a rabid dog because in his sick, twisted mind, he feels threatened and accuses Gloria of sleeping with Anthony. Often he would evict her from the house, but not realizing the night would come when he forces his wife straight into the arms of Anthony. After spending an intense, earth-shattering night of lovemaking, Gloria opens up and confesses to Anthony that she still loves him. Rekindling their relationship is dangerous, and Wayne will stop at nothing to make his wife and her first love's life a miserable hell while fighting his own demons. Wayne harbors a deep, dark, and deadly secret, one he thought he and only the devil knew. Find out what happens when Gloria uncovers the truth about her abusive, lawless husband's mysterious past. The devastation will bring the three of them together in an explosive confrontation. Find out the shocking secrets Wayne harbored and prepare yourself for who will pay the ultimate price for his lawless actions. Gail Delicious Johnson says, Back to Zero will take you where the law becomes the abuser. Order this fast-paced, action-packed field drama by best-selling author Gail Delicious Johnson from her web store at JJ Publishing. That's J-A-Y-J-A-Y publishing.com. Remember, abuse is never an option.
Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, here with my guest this evening, Mary Wingo, who has a PhD, and she's an expert in stress and stress management. So, like I said, if you're out there listening, you have been in stress or you're stressing now, feel free to call in and, you know, you can leave a question or you can ask the question or make a comment. We've just covered a multitude of different effects that stress has on the body and how it trillions of dollars of losses every year. We discussed the five major causes. And also, Mary has written a book, and we're going to discuss a little bit of her book as well. So, Mary, you want to tell us the what makes the impact of the human stress response different from any other books on the market?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, number one, it took about 20 years to really fully compile this and put this together. And so this isn't, okay, so this isn't a clear-cut self-help book, although it has self-help. It's not a book like from an angle, like your typical, you know, like when we typically think about books on stress, we think about sort of like the woo-woo factor. You know, we need to do mindfulness meditation, which is very, very important. It's very, very important. but it's not the whole thing, you know, this, because it's not always with the individual. Again, sometimes we have problems with society as well. You know, you've got two aspects of the stress response. We got the stress which we cause ourselves, but we have uncontrollable stress from the environment that we have to contend with in one way or the other. So it's not your typical book. It's meant to educate the public in general, as well as policymakers, about the basic mechanisms of stress, the costs of stress, which are in the multiples of trillions per year, trillions with a T, okay? Basically, sunk cost of minimum of 10% of global output, you know, so if global output's about 77 trillion, it's minimum 7 trillion that we're looking at in just cost related minimum on a global scale related to preventable stress. So this is something that it's sort of an analysis of stress with self-help, because, you know, I can't just be sitting here, you know, explaining about, you know, all these risks of stress and how, you know, if you do not manage it, you're going to die early, you know, and, you know, and you're going to, you know, basically, you know, lose your health at a very young age. And so it's sort of like a very short analysis that covers just about everything so that the general public can understand, as well as healthcare providers and policymakers. So this is something that is for, it's not meant for a more advanced, like say, scientific audience. This is meant for Joe average, Joe six pack, to understand basically what the, I wouldn't even call it 900-pound gorilla. I call it 900 million thousand-pound gorilla that is in the room, that is staring us squarely in the face. We've got to do something about this, or else we're going to have permanent damage as a society that it's going to be very impossible. Well, I wouldn't say impossible, but nearly impossible to recover if we do not do something like right now.
Okay, why did you decide to write a book on stress?
Well, it was because it's very interesting. In the academic circles, and again, there's many academic circles when it comes to stress, okay? So, again, we can look at this on the hardcore molecular biology level. You know, we can look at this on the whole organism level, whole societal level, that kind of thing. But one thing that hardcore stress researchers have understood is what a risk factor this is. It's like, oh my gosh, this is just absolutely bankrupting society. But because it is so complex, it was very, I kept waiting for somebody else to write this book. I figured that there would be somebody smarter, you know, some Harvard scholar that would do this. Mm-hmm. This is such a complex topic that, you know, you can't just stick to chemistry, physics, and biology. You have to go beyond. And, you know, a lot of times scientists are not very good at going beyond, like, say, you know, going into, like, say, the fields of psychobiology, you know, how the body affects the mind. Go into, you know, how, you know, again, we're looking at herd behavior, how mass psychology, you know, and so if you don't have these various bits of information, you're stuck with your own tiny little view on how stress works, which is very easy. I mean, it's a very complex topic with many hundreds of different aspects. It is not easy to have a comprehensive overview, especially that which the average person can understand. And this is why this work has taken so many years to put together.
Okay. Now, what are the top stresses of the lives of the average reader?
Well, the top stressors are going to be like the five major stressors that I went over a few minutes ago.
Okay.
But how they manage it, I'm sorry, I never really answered your question. I apologize. How did you actually manage stress? Okay, this is sort of the million-dollar question, right? Like, okay, so I'm throwing all these scary statistics at you, and I've got everybody terrified. How do we manage this? Well, ultimately, again, we go back to the original premise. Stress is additive, right? So what one needs to do, and I'm developing a very comprehensive stress assessment application that people can take. I should have that done probably in the next, I don't know, month or so, where people can actually assess their stress. I mean, actually get a fairly good picture of like how much stress they're actually under and risks, you know, that like, hey, you may live 2 decades sooner. You know, you may lose 20 years of life because of the stress. I mean, I can actually, we actually have the technology to assess this so far. So basically what you need to do is you need to itemize all your stresses, okay? And this could run into the hundreds, okay? So it might take weeks, okay? You have to itemize your stresses, okay, somehow, someone, and go through them. Because remember, stressors are like leaks. So you may have these little, niggling stressors, you know, nothing major, that are like little tiny drips. But when you have, like, say, 100 of them, then all of a sudden you've got a major risk factor. All of a sudden, like, oh, okay, you've got a, you know, a major, say, cardiovascular risk factor that just develops from that. So you ultimately have to itemize it, and then through some sort of behavioral modification, existential crisis or whatever, you have to realize that the more stressors that you can eliminate and simplify your life, the less your risk for stress-related injury, early death, and illness becomes. So again, you're mitigating stress by one, by one, by one, by one, by one, eliminating as many stressors as you can. Can you eliminate 100%? No. Can you, like, say, eliminate, the fact that, you know, we're, you know, experiencing some major crisis in our country? No, but you can eliminate a bajillion other stressors that are under your control and that do very quickly make a difference in how you physically feel, very, very quickly. You can very quickly change how your the trajectory of your health of your health and healthcare along with that. So the key is truly identifying and then eliminating. And like I said, I'm developing this application that'll be free for everybody to use. It's not going to cost anything because this is something that it was a humanitarian project, and you know, people need to understand what stress is and how to assess it. So this is going to be available free of charge in the next few weeks, and so your readers will be able to go on my website and take this and be able to actually get some clear numbers of what type of risk they are or are not under. Maybe, you know, they manage their stress well. But if they're a typical American, they're at major risk. They and their family are at major risk of, either losing a family member becoming, becoming handicapped, you know, going on disability or just financial difficulties, because the higher the stress you're under, again, the higher the incidence of financial instability as well. So again, you see where this permeates all levels of our society, and it's very, very important to address this on a profound level.
Let me ask you something. Is worrying and stress different, or are they the same?
I'm sorry. You cut up there. You cut out there. Can you repeat that question?
Is worrying and stress the same, or is there a difference?
Okay. Worrying is a type of stress. Okay. So is worrying stressful? Well, it's a type of stress because, you know, like we said, you know, you've got many different types of stress. I mean, another type of stress, like, for instance, say you are a diabetic and you don't have control of your blood sugar and your blood sugar is shifting many hundreds of points during the day. Well, that's also a type of stressor as well. Worrying is a type of stressor, but there's many other types. Worrying is, let me tell you what worrying is, okay? Worrying is a type of compulsion, like an OCD. It's like, I would say you could put worrying in kind of like the OCD category. And where does that come from? That comes from fatigue of the frontal lobe. So the key is, it's not to fatigue your frontal lobe so that it slips into compulsive behavior.
Okay. Now, how does a person manage their stress?
Well, like I said before, what you do is you analyze your life. You have to be real honest. So again, you might have a lot of heavy thoughts and feelings that go through your mind when you're actually sitting. It was kind of like when you're making, like, say you're trying to lose weight and you like make a food diary and you're like, oh my God, how many, I thought I only ate this much, but in reality, oh my gosh, I'm eating 3,000 calories a day. Or when you're making a diary, like for your budget, you're trying to get your spending under control. You're wondering where all your money's going. And it's like, oh my God, I'm spending so much money, you know, and you have kind of sometimes a crisis, you know, sometimes like a kind of sort of come to Jesus moment. Well, it's going to be even probably worse with stress because this is your life. I mean, this is like, you know, like the truth, like hitting you in the face. Like if I don't do something, then, you know, I'm looking at a shorter lifespan, or I'm looking at, you know, a greater chance of poverty, me and my family, you know. So when you're looking at really hard consequences, you know, I mean, you're really like, oh my gosh, no one explained it to me like this, except for Dr. Wingo. Then you're like, oh, okay, well, I need to do something. So you need to make an itemized list, and then just like when you're going on a diet, you analyze what you're eating, or when you're going on a, you know, budget and you're analyzing what you're spending, you have to analyze how you're spending your life on stresses and get rid especially of the frivolous ones. I mean, start on the low-hanging fruit and then get to the difficult stuff later.
Wow. That is very interesting.
It's really
because
that simple. It's really that simple. Because in the past, we've gotten sort of halfway, what I consider, I should say half-baked, some people's minds. And when someone says, okay, well, just take deep breaths and meditate, you know, do mindfulness meditation. Okay, well, that works, you know, on some forms of stress. Maybe that helps you, again, with that number one stressor of the frontal lobe from, you know, depletion. You know, you're depleting your rational energy, you know, your thought, your thinking process, which is limited. It's very limited. So you're depleting that. Okay, well, you know, so maybe meditation might be good, maybe simplifying. But when you consider that you have, you have like, say, stressors from not having social support. Well, meditation's not going to fix that. Only social support and being affiliated with like-minded people who are looking out for your back where you're not having to worry all the time, that, you know, you see what I'm saying? It's really important to get a handle of what stress actually is. And that, again, this is another reason why I wrote that book. It's to really inform the public of what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Who stresses the most, men or women, or is it equal?
But understand this. There's a reason why men die younger than women. Yeah, it's not genetics. It's because, men
are notoriously horrible at managing their stress. So what? They died 7-8 years younger. Doesn't have to be that way.
So when they're not managing their stress, could that be due to mental or physical or what type of issues are they going through?
Yeah. Well, or not, like, say, controlling a lot of, let me tell you, a lot of, like, say, a lot of older men. My father's one of these people. Let me ask you if you know a man in your life like this. Like, say you got an older gentleman in your life that has type 2 diabetes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how often does that blood sugar go up and down? How many men are good at actually controlling their blood sugar? That you know, I'm sure you know several, probably not very many. So the stress, the chemical stress of up and down, that also shaves a lot of years off life for men and women too. It's not just men, but we're not picking on men, but we're seeing patterns of when men get under stress, you know, what happens to them? You know, what happens? Well, they die early.
Okay, so men and women handle their stress differently, but it's an equal amount of stress that they both go under. Mm-hmm.
And do you know, it's very interesting, and do you know who is the most stressed in our society in America? It's going to be African-American men. And
they're the most stressed.
How long do they live? How long does the average, especially in communities, like very poor communities, like say, for instance, Detroit, parts of like, say, Mississippi, a lot of African-American men are not living much past 50, 55.
Mm-hmm.
What does this do? This do to the many forms of stress the African American men face in our society.
And that's a large thing that contribute to that as far as their living situation, their environment, and how they do things in their life, because most African American men are not employed, have a multitude of babies, and, you know, different things of that nature that causes them to stress. And sometimes
not just that, how about racial profiling by the criminal justice system?
Right. I was going to get into that as well, because they always have to worry about when they're walking down the street or when they're driving or, you know, just whatever they're doing, they always got to be worrying about, am I going to be the next? You know, what's going to happen to me when I walk out this door, you know, opposed to the average white man, you know, doesn't have to worry about that. But it's that is something that is understandable as far as the African-American male is concerned, because of the stress that society and their environment that they go through, as well as diseases and other, you know, complications that come along and, you know, stress them out.
Yeah, I mean, like for instance, again, we'll look at the African, because it's so interesting, the profile of the African-American male. Okay, yeah, you know, so a lot of, especially older African-American males have type 2 diabetes, just like, same with Caucasian and Latino, too. But it's common. And how many of them control their blood sugar? But then, on the other hand, when you're living in a society that's highly unequal, and African-American men are basically at the bottom of the hierarchy, okay? Well, it's going to cause the loss of life. So you can see where, you know, men are men. You know, men are not very good at controlling their blood sugar. So that's going to be, you know, their diets are usually notoriously, sloppy. And we women, you know, kind of remind them. And that's why they live longer a lot of times with women in their life. Women, in many, if it's a good relationship, in many cases, attenuate stress for a man, especially African-American men. But you see where you have external stressors, which are by no means
the African American mantle, but then you have others like, okay, I mean, you know, there's, we need to have more cohesive families on all ends. See, the family has broken down, not just in the African American community, but just all around. I mean, half of all babies are born without married parents. So, and this is just a complete change in our demographic. And we have to, I'm not making moral judgments. What it is that this is, our ancestors did it one way for many hundreds of thousands of years, and all of a sudden, in the last 50, 60, 70 years, things have changed. Well, there are consequences. And so now that we've been in this 50, 60, 70 years, we're seeing the consequences of it. And so, you know, we just need to do a mass education. You know, just like, you know, the campaign for quitting smoking, you know, or the campaign for condom use during the age of AIDS, when AIDS exploded. We need some sort of public health information campaign like that.
Okay. Wow. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation, you know, and a very,
very
interesting
fun.
Topic.
It is.
Yes, because, you know, people need to know what stress does to them and also, you know, how to manage it. You know, be it if you, you know, do as you suggested, or, you know, maybe seeking a psychiatrist or meditating or, you know, whatever it takes to even out that unbalancedness in your chemical makeup, you know, because everybody, including myself, I stress, but I try my best before I see it coming. I try to avoid it, you know, so, but, you know, sometimes it's unavoidable because of the situation you may be in or, you know, whatever's going on at that particular time when you are getting ready to stress out. You know, and like you had mentioned, worrying is a form of stress too. And, you know, some people worry, as you mentioned, about whether they, if they're going to lose their home or if they're going to have a meal or they're going to be homeless and, you know, worrying about their children and, you know, different things like that. So that's some things that, you know, we can't take control of and, you know, have to seek professional help.
Can I share something? And this is a little bit controversial. Well, it's not really controversial, but it's going to sound it. I live here in Ecuador, and the average income is like maybe $3,000 or $4,000 a year, okay? So people don't have a lot of money. But what's really interesting is that there's almost no homelessness. There's almost no, like, say, child malnutrition. There's the stuff that's absolutely endemic. Everyone's got, you know, access to healthcare. Nobody worries about losing a lifetime's worth of, you know, work, going bankrupt from, like, a broken leg, you know, one accident, you know, losing everything that they've worked for all the – No, the system's not set up. I mean, in fact, when I try to tell them about our system, they don't even believe me. They think that I'm exaggerating. Like, yeah, people actually do go bankrupt, you know, from a broken leg. This is not expensive. I mean, they're not, like, running trillion-dollar deficits, you know, kind of keeping people secure, right?
Right.
Keeping people through from their head. So what we're talking about, we're not, when I say that there's really enough to go around, when you step out of our society into other societies where, you know, we're not at war, we're not spending a lot on the military, you know, going to war or trying to take over other countries, or you don't have a big Wall Street that has siphoned. I mean, this is, you know, you can follow the money trails for many decades and paper trails of this. When you, you know, have a, you know, somewhat honest government, you know, they're somewhat, you know, it's not perfect, but accountable. It's not just totally disconnected where people are desperate, because Ecuador has been through that and they don't tolerate that anymore. Then all of a sudden the stress goes down and people start living longer. There are many parts of Ecuador where they don't have 2 cents to rub it. I mean, you've got farmers that are subsistence farmers, but, you know, they've got the basics taken care of by the government, basic transportation, health care, low property taxes, education, free university for their kids, that kind of, the real basic stuff. Nothing much else, but the real. These people are living to be about 100. 90-something, longevity. I'm here in the jungle right now in the Amazon, and these people are, in theory, on paper, very poor. But I was talking to people in the community, and, yeah, they're living to be very, very, very old. So we need to kind of look at how things are structured and how what the reality is, and that we're not too poor. It's just the way that the rich have looted has made us think that we're poorer than what we are. So you know, it's when you move to a more honest system, the stress attenuates and people start living longer, and the healthcare system isn't quite as stressed by sick people. So it's just something to think about.
So is that what made you migrate to Ecuador, or you know, was your
you better believe it. You
oh, okay.
You better believe it. As I was, you know, sort of kind of compiling sort of this, I don't know, mass proverbial database of analysis over the years, I realized that for myself, I realized that the U.S. was turning a very toxic place that was going to result in declining lifespans. You know, a lot of people dying in their 50s and 60s, where maybe a generation ago they were like living to be 80 and 90. When I was like putting this together, I realized that if I stayed in the U.S. under the conditions, my personal conditions I was in, that I would age more rapidly and succumb to stress-related illness, probably fairly young. I realized that for me personally, in order to, you know, basically jive with the stuff that I'd been researching, I mean, to actually like live in a court, I had to leave the U.S. So there was not really any the U.S. kind of sort of needs to be restructured totally from the top down or from the bottom up, you know. But there are many places that actually do have a fairly good understanding, an intuitive understanding of stress mechanisms. And it's usually societies where the indigenous play a role, you know, the Indian of the society still play somewhat of a role. They haven't been exterminated. When you have kind of the older cultures, which had a very good control of stress, they understood these stress mechanisms better than most scientists do today, but they understood it at a more, say, if you want to call it, primitive level. They're the ones that understand that, and we have lost that knowledge of our ancestors. It's just very, very interesting study.
Yeah, very interesting. Yes.
I mean, you can go into how cultures adapt, how cultures change under the pressures of stress. You can look at through history, how cultures disappear because of stress, how civilizations collapse. Jared Diamond, you might have heard of the book, Why Civilizations Collapse. Well, again, it's all due to various forms of stress.
Wow. Are you still there, Mary?
It's not due to things going hunky-dory. If you're adapting, fine, then society's doing fine. It's when things start going wrong that you have to look as a whole at society's stress response. And, if you're policymakers that don't want to deal with constant revolution and instability and things going wrong, then you need to be able to design policies which statistically are most likely to reduce stress in the most amount, the highest percentage of people possible. And you know, these are quite simple and very low cost to implement, but it has to be done if we are to avoid some fairly dire consequences in the very, they're currently occurring in the upcoming 5, 10, 15 years in the future. We need to look at this, but we need to fix this as soon as possible.
Wow, that is so interesting, but we're running out of time, And can you, do you have any last remarks you'd like to give before you give people how they can get in touch with you and how they can get your book as well?
Yes, I want to tell your readers as of like 2 weeks ago, I'm a best-selling author. I'm now best-selling status. Got a lot of interest on Amazon. And they can also go to my website, marywingo.com. There's a lot of freebies. I got a lot of cool videos on YouTube where I go hiking in the Amazon or in the mountains or in the, you know, just in beautiful parts of Ecuador. And I give little talks, little tidbit lectures, kind of like what we talked about today on stress. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of articles, a lot of education, a lot of freebies. People do need to pick up a copy of this book. It's cheap. Anybody can afford it. I want everybody to have access to this. Yeah. People need to have access to this. So this doesn't need to be expensive. It needs to be accessible. And that's what it needs to be.
Wow. Well, this evening's conversation and the topic was very eye-opening for me, as I hope the listening audience, you know, take something from this topic and my guest this evening, Mary Wingo. And, you know, for her stopping by, we're going to give her a great big round of applause. Thank you, guys. Yeah. So, Mary, we'd like to have you come back whenever you're ready. Just, you know, drop me an email, or you can call me or whatever suits you, and we'd like to have you come back when you – pardon?
Absolutely, absolutely, anytime. And you know, a really interesting topic your readers might like, we could talk about, relationship stress and abuse and trauma, you know, that causes some, you know, relationships going awry and going wrong. I'm a very fascinating topic, standpoint.
I definitely would like to have you back as far as relationships, you know, because so many people are having problems with relationships, getting in them, getting out of them, and, you know, how to survive a good relationship and, you know, different things that I such, even myself. So that'll be an excellent topic for you to come back. So, you know, hopefully the beginning of next month, April, you can come back and we can do another topic. Is that okay?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Just drop me a note so I don't forget, because I am crazy busy. But please drop me a note and we'll come back and we will unpack this topic big time.
Right. Because people do. Are, you know, because in this today's society, so many things are going wrong in relationships, and people are yearning to be in relationships, and, you know, it's hard for, you know, women to find that Mr. Right, quote unquote, because I'm putting out a book called The Scent of a Man, and the basic of the book is to let women know that there are still some good men out there. But, you know, women just want everything like yesterday. You have to be patient and diligent in your search for these men, because there are some good men out there. And hopefully I'll have this book out before the end of the year, or, you know, because I started working on it in 2012, but I was derailed because I did another book in between that, and, you know, different things kept coming up. Like I said, I transplanted from D.C. to Fayetteville, North Carolina last year. And, you know, I really am going to, you know, work on getting this book out before this year is up, you know. But I, too, myself have had my share of, you know, going through relationships and, you know, them not being successful, you know, on behalf of infidelity in the relationship, not on my behalf, because any relationship that I've been in, I've always been, I've never cheated in relationships that I've been in, but I've been in relationships where I've been cheated on. So, you know, that'll be an excellent topic when I when you come back in April, and, you know, maybe we can help some people to, you know, recognize the good, the bad, and whatever else is going on with these relationships and how to be in a successful, loving, meaningful relationship. Okay, so thank you, Mary, for stopping by this evening, and I'm looking forward to having you back in April. And, you know, with that being said, thank you, my listening audience, for, you know, stopping by. I always appreciate you guys. And I won't be on next Wednesday. I'll be coming on March the 17th. I'm having a special show for my cousin, my favorite cousin. She died November the 18th, 2016, from cancer. So I'll be, you know, having a show planned, all of her favorite artists, such as Luther Vandross, the OJs, Joan LaVert, the Stylistics, the Temptations, and, you know, so be on the lookout for that. That's March the 17th, and I'll be back on the 22nd, I'll have a show. But, you know, everybody out there who's listening to this show, wish you a beautiful weekend. And if you're going out, don't drink and drive. Don't drive and drink. I love talking to you guys, not about you. With that being said, everybody have a beautiful weekend. Mary, I love you, and thanks again for stopping by Delicious Talk Radio. This is your host, Gail Delicious Johnson. Good night, everybody. Love you guys.
You just listened to the number one radio station on the internet, Delicious Talk Radio. Thank you and good night.